number of rescues were done with ground ladders. I know that the University of Alaska rescued a family of five from the back.
A fire destroys an apartment building in Fairbanks. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state lawmakers debate arming village public safety officers.
You know, the whole crux about the bill is making sure that VPSOs can do their jobs right.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's public schools have new standards in English and math, setting high expectations for students. Students who meet these goals will be ready for success after high school, whether in the military, on the job, or in an apprenticeship, technical school, or college. Ask your school for parent guides to the standards or learn more online at education.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development.
Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest says it is suing over regulations in Alaska that would further define what constitutes a medically necessary abortion for purposes of receiving Medicaid funding. The new regulations are scheduled to take effect on Sunday. Under the regulations, the certificate to request Medicaid funds features two boxes. With the first, a provider would have to certify the pregnancy was the result of rape or incest, or the abortion was performed to save the woman's life. With the second, a provider would have to indicate an abortion was medically necessary to avoid a threat of serious risk to the woman's physical health from continuation of her pregnancy due to impairment of a major bodily function. Attached to it is a list of such impairments. Fire destroyed an apartment building in Fairbanks this morning. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the blaze caused multiple injuries and two residents were unaccounted for as of this morning.
Water cannon doused twisted metal and charred wood left by the fire that collapsed the two-story apartment building where City of Fairbanks Fire Chief Warren Cummings estimates about two dozen people lived. Cummings says firefighters responded before 4 a.m. as the fire accelerated.
Flames very much visible.
Chief Cummings says several fire departments, including one from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, were involved in the initial response, which was focused on getting people out of the building.
A number of rescues were done with ground ladders. I know that the University of Alaska rescued a family of five from the back of the structure, and there was a number of other people rescued. We transported some people to the hospital. One of the people was burned pretty bad. They've been since transferred to Harborview in Washington.
Cummings says one firefighter was also injured, and the status of two apartment residents was unknown as of this morning.
We're still in the process of accounting for people from two apartments. We don't know if they were at work or out of town or what, so we're working on that.
Chief Cummings says the apartment building and a downstairs furniture store are a total loss, but firefighters were able to keep the flames from spreading into an adjoining produce and meat market.
There is damage in there. We had to pull the ceilings to stop any fire spread.
It's pretty bad as far as I can tell. We've lost a lot of meat.
Richard Mulholland, a butcher at the Homegrown Market, says a lot of cleanup will have to take place before the store can reopen. Chief Cummings says the fire started in the center of the apartment building on the second floor, and investigators will be looking into the cause once the scene is safe. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Criminal justice reform may be coming to Alaska. After spending the summer collecting more information on efforts in other parts of the country, the Senate Judiciary Committee has started holding hearings again on their omnibus crime bill. The legislation would raise the dollar threshold for nonviolent crimes like shoplifting and writing bad checks to be considered felonies. It would also set up a prisoner reentry fund to help ex-convicts return to society, and it would create a criminal justice commission tasked with regularly reviewing the effectiveness of Alaska's sentencing laws and making sure they're in line with penalties in other states. Senator John Coghill, who chairs the Judiciary Committee, says the bill has the potential to save the state money and improve public safety outcomes.
We're trying to say we can't afford to build another jail.
Alaska has the worst recidivism rate in the country. Two-thirds of the state's prisoners eventually go back after their release. A legislative committee discussed a proposal yesterday to allow arming village public safety officers in rural Alaska. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Representative Bryce Edgman of Dillingham is the bill's chief sponsor. He told the committee that the measure would establish protocols and funding for bringing qualified VPSOs through firearms training. In addition to high rates of turnover, issues with pay, housing, and facilities, Representative Edgman enumerated the safety concerns voiced by VPSOs.
You know, the whole crux about the bill is making sure that VPSOs can do their jobs right. A VPSO walks into a situation that sometimes is lethal, and he or she is armed with a baton, with a taser, they've got handcuffs on them, and they're wearing a protective vest. And unfortunately, I'm here to tell you, as somebody born and raised in rural Alaska, the social issues, the numbers of domestic violence calls, the episodes of violent confrontations have been on the increase.
The funding structure laid out in the current draft of the bill would bring 20 qualified candidates annually through a training program at the Police Academy in Sitka. At just over $62,000 a year, the funding would cover travel, liabilities, lodging, and firearm equipment for the VPSOs who complete the program, and ultimately, the regional entities in a given area would decide whether they want their VPSOs to carry firearms at all. For the majority of the two-hour session, calls from across the state, exclusively from current or former law enforcement officials, poured in. What emerged was a patchwork of perspectives on the problems policing rural Alaska. The litany of testimony offered circled around the issue of state law enforcement relying more and more on VPSOs to help with rural policing, but weariness over current and future regulations and standards within the program. At its most generous, the criticism focused just on specific points in implementation. And at the other end, Jake Metcalf, executive director for the union representing public safety officials, says the expanding reliance on VPSOs is an inadequate way of compensating for a more costly trooper presence across the state.
They're not certified police officers, so I think rural Alaska is getting a different type of law enforcement than the municipalities and a lot of regions of the state that have significant trooper resources.
What was not questioned is that violence against law enforcement officials has been steadily increasing. The very impetus for HB 199 reigniting the decades-old debate on whether or not to arm VPSOs was the death of a Manicotek officer last March. Former Department of Public Safety Commissioner Joe Masters says the hazards have led some VPSOs to break the law by arming themselves in order to do their jobs.
With these escalations in the use of force against them, which they certainly know about, their job is becoming more and more dangerous to the point where there are VPSOs that are carrying firearms today against the regulations that are in place and against policies that are in place that prohibit them.
Criticism of and recommendations for HB 199 were in abundant supply during the session, but the vast majority of those who spoke were ultimately in support of it. Representative Neil Foster's remarks on the discussion summed up the prevailing sentiment.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to reiterate and maybe support some of the comments that were said earlier, and that is, until we can get more resources out to rural Alaska so that we can give the same level of protection to folks out in rural Alaska as we do in other parts of the community, then, you know, I think this bill is a step in the right direction, and it's doing something that we can do now with a minimal amount of resources.
Committee co-chair Gabrielle Ledoux did not bring the bill to a vote. Instead, she ended yesterday's session asking legislators to consider all they'd heard and saying that in her own experience, guns are an integral component to life in Bush, Alaska. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the only woman who's running the Yukon Quest talks about her motivations.
My goal is to finish. You know, I don't care where I finish. Granted, I don't really want to be last, but if I'm last and I finish, I'm fine with that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. And by the 2014 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
The U.S. House today passed a farm bill that includes programs for Alaska unrelated to agriculture. The bill continues another year of funding for payment in lieu of taxes, a program that pays municipalities surrounded by federal land to compensate for the loss of a tax base. The so-called PILT program sends about $26 million a year to Alaska and is a large portion of the budget for some local governments. The bill also renews Alaska's Village Safe Water program, which gets some $30 million a year from the federal government. The final bill did not include a proposed cut to the food stamp program, which Congressman Don Young says would have hurt thousands of Alaska families. The farm bill passed overwhelmingly in the House and is expected to come up for a final vote in the Senate next week. President Obama gave his State of the Union address last night, and the response from Alaska's U.S. senators was swift and negative, particularly to Obama's pledge to act without Congress where he can. Senator Lisa Murkowski issued a video rebuttal.
Going it alone is not a solution, and it's counterproductive in government. Consensus building is hard, but it's 100% doable.
Senator Mark Begich, the only Alaska Democrat in Congress, took swipes at the president, too. He says Obama should have focused on oil and gas development, and he promises he won't sit idle if the president attempts what Begich calls an executive power grab. Here's how he put it to Jake Tapper on CNN.
So I'll be anxious to see what these executive orders are, but if they go too far, you'll clearly hear pushback from me. There's no question about it.
Two of the Republicans hoping to unseat Begich issued press releases trying to show Begich and the president are acting as one. Dan Sullivan's statement a day ahead of the speech slammed what he calls the failed Obama-Begich agenda. Mead Treadwell's press release blames Obama and Begich for being at the helm while output in the Alaska pipeline declines. A third Republican challenger, Joe Miller, didn't mention Begich in his post-speech statement, but called Obama's agenda willfully divisive. A Juneau woman says getting insurance under the Affordable Care Act means she'll take better care of herself. Prior to January 1st, Bonnie Berg was paying up to $1,000 a month for health insurance. Now she's paying less than $100. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Bonnie Berg spent most of her professional career working in social services. She always had insurance through her job, and when she retired in August 2010, she kept it through COBRA.
I was paying about $1,000 a month and about $250 each quarter for my basic meds. So in other words, it was costing me $13,000 a year just for the dead basics.
After 18 months on COBRA, Berg switched to a catastrophic plan, which cost $526 each month. She paid close to $900 every quarter for two asthma medications. Her deductible was $5,000. In the 40 months since retirement, Berg went to the doctor only twice.
I wasn't willing to pay for any tests on my own. I wasn't willing to do anything the doctor really wanted me to do. So I probably allowed myself the worst medical care of my life during the time that I was paying huge prices.
When the Affordable Care Act became law, Berg wanted to be on a health plan as soon as she could, though she will qualify for Medicare in 8 months.
This is going to save me $4,000 or $5,000 just in 8 months. If anything happens, it's going to save me a lot more than that.
Berg now pays $90 a month for health insurance. Her deductible is $250, and her maximum out-of-pocket is $500. Enroll Alaska's Chief Operating Officer, Tyann Bowling, says Berg's case is not rare.
We get a lot of very, very happy people that are getting health insurance for the first time, or they're getting health insurance that's affordable to them for the first time.
Bowling says about 80% of people signing up with Enroll Alaska receive financial assistance. Juneau's United Way navigator Crystal Borland says people are also happy to find their plans include free preventative services like cholesterol screenings, colonoscopies, and immunizations.
Regardless of which plan they choose, they can still go to the doctor to get preventative and wellness checks. Just some of those added protections that exist under the Affordable Care Act, I think, is usually pretty surprising for people.
Despite the positives, Enroll Alaska's Bowling says the health brokerage firm has made 1,100 enrollments. but she thinks that should be at least 15,000 by now. She blames the early troubles with the healthcare.gov website.
We lost 2 full months of enrolling people, and those were critical months. That's where the momentum was, and we couldn't get people enrolled. I think that we lost a lot of people, and we lost them for good.
Bonnie Berg was not one of those people. She worked with an agent for more than a month before she successfully enrolled in mid-December. Now she says she's ready to take better care of herself.
I'm going to be putting some thought into my health, which is a good thing for anybody to do.
The deadline to apply for a plan that starts in March is February 15th. Open enrollment ends March 31st and won't begin again until November. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
With education being a hot issue this legislative session, some politicians are looking at the basics of learning in their effort to improve student outcomes. Today, the Senate Education Committee held its first hearing on a bill that would establish a reading program targeted at kindergarten through third grade. Gary Stevens chairs that committee, and he's sponsoring the bill. The goal is to reach struggling students early instead of playing a difficult and costly game of catch-up.
You'd think that everyone who's an adult out there with a job can read, but it appears that that's not always the case, that there are people struggling somewhere along the way. They didn't pick up on that ability and have never since.
The bill would require school districts to conduct reading assessments to identify students who need extra support to read at grade level. During the hearing, Stephen said many Alaska school districts are already taking those steps with their students, but acknowledged it could be a challenge for smaller districts. The Department of Education is reserving judgment on the bill, but Deputy Commissioner Les Morris says he appreciates the intent.
Is this the absolute right direction? I think it's interesting to hear from districts, but there are some very good and important approaches to reading instruction that are embedded within this legislation.
If approved, the reading program is expected to cost the state $200,000. A report released this week by the Annie E. Casey Foundation says Alaska is in the bottom 10 states for childhood reading proficiency. About 3/4 of Alaska students are not reading at grade level.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, announcing the 2014 Board of Directors election beginning January 22nd. Early bid proxy submission needed by Friday, February 14th. Information at doyon.com. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The Alaska Department of Transportation opened up a section of the Richardson Highway today. DOT cleared avalanches from the North Road, the road north of Mile 19, but the highway is still closed between Miles 12 and 19. In that area, water behind a massive avalanche dam in the Keystone Canyon is receding due to the low river flowing once again. During an interview with KCHU this morning, DOT maintenance engineer Jason Sakalaskas said the river's flow rate has decreased since Monday.
It was decreasing about 5 inches per hour. Right now it's down to about 2 to 3 inches per hour. But that's no cause for alarm.
Sakalaskas did not say how much longer the water depth needs to be before crews can gain access to the area.
We'd like to see most of the water off of the roadway before we begin breaking loose the lower portion of the dam for obvious reasons. But we're willing to, you know, be in there with a little bit of water work, so.
No one knows when the Richardson Highway is going to reopen, but the Valdez Parks and Recreation Department is hoping everyone in the state has a fun time guessing. They've started a Nenana Classic-style contest to see who can accurately predict when the highway closure will end. They hope it will be a fun distraction as residents wait for the highway to reopen. The person who guesses the closest time will win a prize package worth $100. A study to help establish goat hunting guidelines on Baranoff Island has revealed much more than how to manage the goat population. It has sparked a mystery. KCAW's Emily Foreman has the story.
On a cloudless September day on Baranoff Island, Kevin White,
a goat researcher from Juneau, and Phil Mooney, Sitka's wildlife management biologist, are looking for mountain goats. When the helicopter hovers within 30 feet of the goat, White leans out of the open door with one foot on the skid and aims at a dirty spot on the goat's coat the size of a saucer, a natural bullseye of dirt on the otherwise brilliant white coat.
And I think he's only missed two out of about 400, so he's got it down.
That's Phil Mooney. He says hitting the goat with a dart is one thing. Recovering the goat is another.
And I'm sitting on the opposite ridge as I see Kevin bail out of the helicopter going after the goat that's headed for the cliff.
White had darted the goat with a heavy tranquilizer that takes 7 minutes to kick in. It would be a grisly end for the goat if it were bounding over the cliff once it did.
And I'm thinking he's still got his flight suit on, and then goat horns are sharp. He gets tangled up with that, and the goat goes off the cliff. He's going to go with it. And he ended up about 11 feet from the edge of the cliff.
Almost a century before biologists were jumping out of helicopters to tackle 300-pound mountain goats, there were no reported goat sightings on Baranoff Island.
This place was covered by miners in the late 1800s and early 1900s searching for gold and silver. Nobody reported seeing goats.
Back then, residents wanted more big game hunting options. So, in 1923, the state transplanted 18 goats to Baranoff Island from Tracy Arm. To protect the population, wildlife biologists have been studying the goats ever since through aerial surveys, GPS tagging, and tissue samples.
Which is nothing more than a piece of flesh about the size of a pencil eraser.
The DNA in those samples revealed something unexpected. Evidence suggesting that an unknown goat population may have already been living on Baranoff Island before the Tracy Arm transplant. Mooney says that they were only expecting to find the Tracy Arm DNA in the tissue samples.
Lo and behold, there was other DNA in there.
10,000 years ago, Southeast Alaska was covered in hundreds of feet of glacial ice, except for a few isolated pockets called refugia. The samples Mooney and White found matched DNA from an Ice Age goat population near Haines. That means the transplanted goats bred with goats that were already on Baranoff Island, but were absolutely unknown. Mystery goats.
What, a UFO came and dropped off a bunch of goats? How could that be?
Call it a case of wildlife management meets paleobiology. Phil Mooney plans to tackle that question in time, but right now it's about keeping tabs on Baranoff Island's current goat population. Along with gathering tissue samples, Mooney tracks the animal's movement with bright orange GPS collars. GPS stands for Global Positioning System.
It's just like a kitchen timer. It's nothing fancy at all, but when that day and time come up, it sets off a small explosive charge in the collar that blows the springs on the plate that holds the collar together, and the collar falls to the ground.
At $5,000 a piece, Mooney makes sure to retrieve the collars. If a goat dies in an avalanche and is carried down a valley, Mooney might end up in Devil's Club up to his head fishing for the device. But Mooney says it's worth it. The goats aren't harmed. White reverses the tranquilizer with an injection, and within minutes the goat is up and running. And they've learned a lot from the data. Mainly, the best way to protect nannies. It's the reason why there are goat hunting zones, why shooting a single nanny will close a zone, and why we still have a goat hunting season at all.
We've got a situation up by Yakutat where the population declined significantly. It's been closed now 13 years.
Goat hunting is rigorous. Not many have the stamina to traverse high rocky cliffs, shoot a 250-pound animal, and then pack out a heavy load of meat and hide. But a wildlife management strategy based on science can produce fundamental discoveries important to all of us, and not just to the hunters. In Sitka, I'm Emily Foreman.
There's only one woman in the Yukon Quest field of 18 mushers. Fairbanks musher Mandy Nauman has been training dogs for the last 8 years. KUAC's Emily Schwing has this profile.
In a recent email, Mandy Nauman says that if she can inspire one little girl to follow her dreams, then she's done her job as a female musher. But beyond that, she isn't likely to focus on being the only woman to race a dog team in the Yukon Quest this year.
I am a rookie. Very much a rookie.
It's clear she's nervous about the race, but driving a dog team in the Quest has been a long-time goal for the 32-year-old Minnesota native.
Well, I've been running dogs for about 8 years, but I've gotten pretty serious about in the last 3 years.
Nauman wasn't the only woman to sign up for the race. But after a recent withdrawal, she's the only woman who will start this year.
My goal is to finish. You know, I don't care where I finish. Granted, I don't really want to be last. But if I'm last and I finish, I'm fine with that.
She can't exactly explain what it is about sled dogs that gets her fired up. But she caught the mushing bug at Vermilion Community College in Ely, Minnesota years ago.
One of the classes I had to take was a dog mushing class, and I played softball for the college, and my softball coach was also the dog sled instructor. So he had taken me out a couple times, and I was just like, and I had been to Alaska a couple summers before I worked in Denali, so I knew about dog mushing, and I was just like, I'm going back to Alaska, so I dropped out of college and moved up here to Fairbanks.
That's when she met seven-time finisher Brent Sass. The two worked together at Chena Hot Springs, and they've been friends ever since.
You know, when I first started mushing, getting into long-distance mushing, Brent was the guy I was working with. So I've known his dogs for 8 years. You know, like I love them. They're, you know, they're part of my family, and I couldn't imagine running anybody else's dogs, honestly.
She spent the fall training up 12 dogs from Sass's Wild and Free Mushing for this year's race. Like her, many of those dogs are also rookies.
I have four dogs that are under the age of 3 right now.
But she's not fazed by their inexperience. By the time she gets to the start line, she says her team will also include a few veteran dogs.
You know, a lot of these dogs have been on that trail, which is going to be huge. So they're going to teach me, you know, they're going to teach me the trail, and they're going to teach me, you know, a lot of things.
Like what?
Well, you know, like, I don't know, to be tough, you know, and like teach me, you know, to like be patient and take my time and not stress out about the little things and, you know, just like do what I do best, and that's take care of the dogs.
Mandy Nauman and her dog team will line out at the start of the 31st annual Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race in downtown Fairbanks on Saturday. I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Tony Gorman in Valdez, and Emily Foreman in Sitka. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Platt. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska. Electronic health records give doctors, nurses, and families secure access to medical information when and where it's needed most. If it's providing a new doctor access to your child's medical history or taking a loved one to the emergency room, electronic health records provide safe, secure, life-saving information on the spot. For more information, go to ak-ehealth.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in partnership with the Alaska eHealth Network. A message to parents from the Alaska Department of Education. Learning to read is the basis for all future learning. Parents can help their children get off to a good start as readers. Read with your young children every day. Do lots of talking with your kids. Make up stories together. Play games with words like rhyming games. Encourage your kids to write and draw stories and ask your school how you can help your children become good readers. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.